What were the key takeaways from the Merger Market Private Equity Forum in New York? What did our panelists have to say about topics including exits, valuations, and value creation? And how does what's happening or will happen this year in the US private equity market affect and impact other regions globally? We'll be discussing all this and more in today's episode of the Merger Market Private Equity Podcast. Hello, listener, and welcome to this new episode of the Merger Market Private Equity Podcast. I'm Harriet Matthews. I'm the European Funds Editor at Merger Market, and I'll be your host for today's episode. We're recording this episode in Ion Analytics New York office shortly after Merger Market's Private Equity Forum in New York, which saw private equity market participants gather in the Pierre Hotel in New York for a day of panels and networking. We'll be talking in this episode about the key takeaways from the event and what this means for the US private equity outlook for 2024. I'm also pleased to say that we have a full house of Merger Market's global fund editors today to discuss this. So joining me is Tom Kane, funds editor in North America, and Tim Burrows, who is the managing editor of AVCJ, part of Merger Market. Tim and Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks, Harriet. Great to be on the podcast today.
Great to have you both here. Now, let's start off with a couple of the topics that were very much on US sponsors' minds at the forum, and I think are on their minds, you know, broadly at the moment in the current market: deal flow and valuations. Tom, maybe turning to you first, what did you glean about the mindset of sponsors around both of those themes?
I think it's very interesting, Harriet. We heard about a very choppy, bifurcated market. And specifically, there's a bifurcation between high quality assets that are continuing to command premiums in terms of valuations and lesser quality assets. And for those, there's more scrutiny over valuations and skepticism from buyers over, you know, where their EBITDA levels really lie. There's considerable buyer caution. And I think one other interesting thing we heard about is that due diligence processes are being extended amid this increased scrutiny and this buyer caution.
I really like the comment in the first panel from one of our panelists saying, I may get the numbers the wrong way around here, but they had rejected more deals in the past, was it 14 months? And they had done in the past 9 years. And a lot of that was based on EBITDA adjustments. They gave the example of if you think you're buying into a 40 million EBITDA company versus a 20 million, how very different that prospect is. And I think those are good themes to pick up on, Tom. What about you, Tim? What did you make of that topic and theme at the forum?
Yeah, I mean, the valuations point is interesting and it's globally relevant. People are having trouble building up conviction around assets, given the cost of capital's gone up. You may not be getting the multiple expansion on exit. So it's really a case of what you can do with it during the ownership period. And that means that when you're going in, you're going to scrutinize the valuation a lot more. I mean, that was a great example. It was, the claim the EBITDA is 40. It's really 20. They've bought 10 million in EBITDA, but they've actually not integrated it. And so there's quite a lot of heavy lifting you've got to do with that company. And yet they're coming to you saying, we want this valuation, we want this multiple. And the private equity sponsors just can't make that add up in the current environment.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why we also had a panelist say, and I think our data from Merger Market reflects this, transaction volumes or kind of the volumes overall haven't necessarily been as affected as we might think they would be in the kind of market we are in. And that's because it typically is those premium assets that are transacting. So their valuations haven't been hit too hard. And we had the same comment in the forum we had in Frankfurt in late April in Germany, sort of talking about how it's quite a kind of, it's a very, you know, clear-cut, bifurcated, I think there's a black and white market where deals are either getting done or they aren't, which sounds very basic, but it does reflect the type of assets that are actually trading. Now, turning to the theme of exits, we had some Merger Market data at the forum showing that it had been a fairly strong Q1 for exit volume. But where are we headed for the remainder of the year? Tom, can I get you to take that one first?
Yeah, I was really interested in that panel because we've been hearing from bankers that the considerable prep is going on behind the scenes for a busier second half. In terms of the data, the Q1 data did show quite a big pickup, about 40%, but obviously that's coming from a very low base last year compared, you know, to previous years. In spite of everything we've just mentioned, one point I really picked up on was that there is pressure to transact because of the need for liquidity. And that means that our panelists are expecting a busier second half. I do think that we will see a focus on quality assets, as we've discussed previously. I think areas like technology will be in particular focus, where you're seeing those high quality assets that are attracting, you know, strong interest versus the lesser quality assets that we talked about before, where there's considerable skepticism.
And it was mentioned in a panel later on, thinking about technology, a lot of tech exits need to be made because there was a lot of activity in tech, I think, in 2021 in particular. And one panelist made the point that some LPs committing to buyout funds may have ended up with quite a bit more exposure than they would have initially anticipated in the tech sector.
I think that's a really good point, Harriet. We've actually reported that cybersecurity and fintech are two areas where we expect to see a pickup in deal activity.
Interesting. And Tim, what did you make of all the talk around exits at the forum?
Yeah, I want to pick up on Tom's observation about private equity firms being compelled to act. Because you've had an environment where it's perhaps been inopportune. You're not going to get the valuations you maybe wanted on exit. And so people have just held on. Maybe to those assets that are not the trophy assets that do still command the premium. But now, you know, you're thinking about your next fundraiser, you're looking at the distributions you've not made, and maybe you're going to be in a position where you just have to bite the bullet and sell at that maybe less attractive valuation.
Now, obviously linked to the theme of exits, a lot of time was spent at the forum on GP-led secondaries. It came up in a number of panels. And obviously, Tom, you hosted a panel on that very theme. So I wanted to get a sense from both of you of what you made of that. Tom, maybe you'll get your take first.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting to hear about what was described as a virtuous cycle of increased allocations into private markets. Then you've got the need for liquidity, as we've mentioned. And then you've also got significant innovation in the secondary space, particularly with GP-led secondaries. We've actually reported quite a bit on this, about the convergence of some of the deal structures with what you would typically see in M&A, for example. So that's just one example of innovation. We're also seeing ever-increasing amounts of new entrants going into the space. So that's really driving the growth of the market. But what we also heard about is there's a serious capitalization issue in the GP-led market in particular, where there's just not enough capital currently to support the flow of opportunities.
And Tim, how does that compare to Asia, for example? And what did you make of the kind of theme at the forum?
The challenge in Asia is a bit different. There are a lot of GPs that want to do secondaries. The problem you have is getting LPs comfortable anchoring those continuation funds, simply because a lot of the main secondaries investors are investing from global funds. So the Asia deal has to stack up against the North America deal. And a lot of the time it doesn't stack up. And so they just do the North America deal. So that's why we haven't really seen that many GP-led secondaries in Asia. One remark maybe one of the panelists that did actually make me laugh a bit was LP-led secondaries were described as levered beta. GP-led secondaries were described as unlevered alpha. And that kind of really captured that, I guess, enthusiasm for GP-led secondaries that we're seeing across the industry. It is interesting that people still talk about the education aspect, that GPs perhaps don't fully understand their options. But at the same time, to Tom's point, you're increasingly seeing secondaries as part of the M&A infrastructure. It's no longer a strange thing to consider. It's basically, I might do a trade sale, I might do an IPO, I might do a sponsor-sponsor sale, or I could do a continuation fund. The interesting observation that was made was what that means for the advisors. So you've got advisors that are recruiting M&A professionals. You've got advisors that are teaming up with banks because they need to provide that end-to-end service. And that really underlines, I think, just how secondaries are becoming a bigger part of the industry and a part that's not going to go away.
I think those are really, really fascinating observations. And I quite like the fact that the kind of broader trend of GPs holding onto assets for longer was brought up. Obviously, holding periods have extended, but GPs are often using GP-led deals to argue that they are the right asset manager to manage an asset, which sounds very basic, but previously I don't think GP-led deals were thought of in quite that same way. And, you know, there's more permanent capital in the market, there are more evergreen funds in the market, and I think it's interesting to see GP-leds as part of that wider picture as well. Now, underlying this, of course, is, you know, one of my favorite topics, the fundraising market. We heard from LPs throughout the day, and I also hosted a dedicated panel to get their perspectives. What did you both make of their outlook? Tim, can I start with you first?
Obviously, I cover Asia, and so I'm always going to look at stuff through an Asia lens. And fundraising in Asia is awful. It's as difficult as it's ever been, I think. So to get that US perspective, clearly there was, I guess, to some extent, I guess, guarded optimism. But certainly the sentiment was not as poor as it has been in Asia in the last sort of year or so.
No, I think that's true. And I think it's all linked to the kind of potential exit uptick, you know, slightly different kind of geopolitical situation as well, obviously. Tom, what did you make of it?
I think 2 points. Just on fundraising, I was interested to hear about the haves and have-nots in fundraising. So a point was made that your capital is continuing to pour into the mega funds of over $5 billion. But then further down, that's where people are seeing, you know, challenges, a more challenging environment to raise funds. In terms of LP perspectives, I really liked your panel, Harriet. I picked up on a couple of interesting perspectives around the alternative liquidity solutions we've discussed just now, continuation funds and NAV financing. So on the continuations fund side, it was interesting to hear that some of the LPs feel that they've been, you know, overused in the market. And that really contrasts with, you know, what we heard from the secondaries buyers earlier in the day about how, you know, there's not currently enough of these deals being done and there's more capital needed to support increased deal flow. So very interesting to hear the LP perspective on that. And then when it comes to NAV financing, you described it as, you know, love-hate, and it was very clear that some of the LPs were firmly in the hate camp, so to speak. So I think that was really interesting to get those perspectives.
Yeah, and that's very much a topic that's still going on, I think. Obviously, it's most prevalent around larger managers now, but as it, you know, proceeds further down, GPs will need to think about how they pitch it to their LPs, the use of that financing.
Yeah, I mean, the skepticism is always going to be, are you using it to provide distributions? And that's basically what the LPs don't want to see. So I think if you're clear about your motivations, then it can be understood and accepted. I mean, I think that people often make the comparison with secondaries, because there was skepticism about the use of secondaries. And then you had ILPA come out, there was guidance, I guess some kind of best practice. And so the LPs got a bit more comfortable with it. And maybe we're going to see the same thing happen with NAV financing, as there are stronger best practices around it, as you get guidance from groups like ILPA, then the GPs will have a clear idea of what they can and can't do, and the LPs will be more comfortable when they see it.
It's definitely a topic that's not going away, and I'll be curious to see how that develops as well. I think that's a very good point around, you know, when there's more guidance, potentially more comfort, we could see things shift a little bit, very much about how you use it, because LPs want distributions, but they don't all seem to want those distributions from NAV financing. In terms of other themes that kind of emerged throughout the day, is there anything else you'd both think is worth mentioning, you know, for our listeners? Tom, maybe starting with you.
2 things I think are worth mentioning. So amid the difficult environment for deals, the higher interest rate environment, value creation came up a lot. We had a panel dedicated to it, but it did come up on a few of the other panels as well. There's an increased focus on value creation, and technology is a big part of that as well. So sponsors are thinking about how they can use technology from a very early stage to create value in their portfolio companies. So that was one takeaway for me. Another one was private credit. Increasingly, private equity sponsors starting private credit operations as well. And we heard about, you know, that being a really smart strategy because they can leverage synergies across their platforms in doing that.
Absolutely. That whole wider trend of PE firms kind of becoming asset managers is evident there. Tim, what about you?
Yeah, with regard to value creation, and if we go back to post-GFC, that's where you had things like Capstone being created by KKR. And that was really where you sort of, I guess, you got value creation, maybe became, I guess you could say, it became institutionalized, or it certainly became part of the furniture of private equity firms. And what we're seeing is just an acceleration of that, which is entirely logical and should happen. I mean, as mentioned before, if you can't rely on financial engineering for your returns, you can't necessarily rely on multiple expansion, then it does really come down to what you can do with that company during ownership. And we've seen private equity firms not only increase the size of their operating teams, if that is their model, and it's not always the case, but add sort of greater functional expertise in things, specifically in things like the use of data, the use of technology. And yeah, I guess that's just going to continue.
Definitely. One thing that I don't think came up too much was the kind of bolt-on side of value creation. We've, you know, seen GPs applying more scrutiny, as we touched on earlier, to EBITDA adjustments around bolt-ons. So I'll be quite curious to see how that side of things develops, because, you know, we're still seeing plenty of buy and build across all sorts of different sectors. And it's one way to deal with, you know, situations where the cost of capital is higher and you have to rely on different kind of value creation levers. But I think that's another theme that I'm curious to see how that turns out. I think sponsors are really realizing that they do have to do the integration work rather than simply kind of buying a lot and building but not integrating.
There was one other point that wasn't mentioned that I wanted to just reference here. We didn't hear at all about the elections, which are coming up in November, and the impact they could have on the outlook for the second half. And I found that quite surprising, as in the previous election cycle, there was a lot of focus on that. I wonder whether that's because we're in this environment where people are very much focused on interest rates and what the Federal Reserve is going to do. Also, it's an election where there's two candidates that the people know well. So perhaps less uncertainty about a surprise candidate, so to speak.
There are elections happening all over the place this year, and I was writing about the implications of that a few months ago. The interesting thing was that for people in Asia, the concern really wasn't so much the elections taking place in countries in Asia. It is actually the US election. And then what that might mean for the geopolitical situation with regard to China and other markets. So, yeah, it was just interesting that it didn't come up in the conference yesterday. But if you sort of spoke to a selection of Asian private equity managers about how they feel about elections, they're going to say we're more concerned about the US one than we are, say, about the Indian one.
I think the US is still so dominant, and we very much look to the US in Europe. I think a lot of the signals around activity picking back up, that kind of thing, we're seeing in the US, and the hope will be that in a few months' time in Europe, we're in a similar place. Well, I think we'll wrap up the episode there, but thank you so much, both of you, for joining me, Tom and Tim. It's been great to hear your insights.
Thanks, Harry. It was a pleasure to be on the podcast today.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you like the podcast, then please don't forget to subscribe via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you again in the next episode.